The newspaper column is one of those conventions that we think of as old as movable type, but it's not. 800, usually 800 words of purposefully subjective prose, be it impassioned, purple, or persuasive. It's more or less a recent invention, but is it powerful? It sure is. Long after the details of most stories fade, ask a newspaper reader about a specific column, and usually they can recall a specific turn of phrase, a specific citation of fact, or a shocking reveal at the end. And while there are collections of columnists, there has been no great attempt to lay out the history of the column and to gather the best ones until this book, Deadline Artists, America's Greatest Newspaper Columns. It has three editors, John Avlon, Jesse Angelo, Era Lewis, and all three gentlemen join me today. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Good morning.
Good to be with you.
Shockingly, are you there on the phone?
Yep, I'm here.
All right, good. Shockingly, some of the oldest ones that matter that are collected here, like What's the Matter with Kansas? You'd think a column from 1896 would be really creaky and unreadable, but it's not. And I wonder, is because most newspapers of 115 years ago are, to what do you attribute that? Is there something about the column that makes it a lot more accessible?
Well, our criteria in putting this book together was real simple. Great writing, whose power endured beyond a particular news cycle. And the best of the old columnists, like William Allen White, frankly like Westbrook Pegler, like Haywood Broun, their prose has not aged a lot at all. And I think it's a tribute to what just craftsmen they were. There are some folks whose prose sounds dated, but the best don't, because I think they're kind of throwing that hardball.
I think Mike, we found as we went through it, it was amazing how many of the so-called greats, their stuff really didn't hold up, and you'd go back and read it, and it really wasn't very good, or it sounded very dated, or it just sounded very tin. But some things, such as What's the Matter with Kansas, have such power because it really is a clarion call for political boldness, and that sort of rings across the ages no matter what the topic.
Right. So an example of tin sounding might that be like a Walter Winchell column, which today I know he's in the book, but you know, it's inverted syntax and Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea
exactly
and all that.
Right, exactly right. It's this sort of staccato kind of quick storytelling about something, about a subject, frankly, in many cases that didn't particularly matter all that much or that was resolved fairly soon. I mean, look, you look at just this week in the Daily News, nice column today by Lupica about whether or not Governor Christie is going to run for president. And it's interesting, but it's disposable. You know, it's well-crafted. It's a good read, thought-provoking. Will it matter next week? No, probably not.
But there's some value in that, for sure. I mean, if you want to read a good Christie column,
of course,
that's one to read.
Sure, and I think, you know, these columns have different purposes. What we were trying to collect here in Deadline Artists is to point out the fact that there's work composed in a disposable medium which actually can be transcendent. You read Jimmy Breslin, who had 3 hours to write after the assassination of John Lennon, a column called Are You John Lennon, which is beautiful. You've got Pete Hamill writing on the day of 9/11. Those things hold up. I mean, this is an incredibly creative process. All of us are young journalists. We did this because we wanted to learn from the best of the past. But there's something incredibly creative about this work that endures and that is inspiring and an education as well.
So you mentioned the great Jimmy Breslin column. He's here a few times. Yes, he wrote that in 3 hours. He wrote that in a tight deadline. But it took a lifetime of him having contacts with the police, because it's all about the policeman who arrived at the Dakota the day John Lennon was shot and transported him to the hotel. So in those 800 in those 800 words or so, it's informed by, you know, the hard work that he put together all his life. It's not an easy thing to dash off.
Not at all.
No, that's right. I mean, you've got what we learned from Malcolm Gladwell, right? You've got to put in your 10,000 hours if you want mastery of anything. Well, that's true here. And in all seriousness, I mean, we waded through hundreds and hundreds of columns, and we picked the ones where they managed to smash one out of the park. It doesn't happen every day.
To your point, Mike, I think most of the ones that really do endure, especially from the likes of Breslin and the other big city columnists, are the ones that are reported columns, where it's not just an opinion and somebody sitting behind a desk saying what they think about the news of the day, but where they actually got out in the streets and they interviewed people and they went and covered a story and also brought their opinion and their idea to bear on it. And those are the ones that really endure.
A column can be just a columnist's opinion, but you're right, to be great, it probably just shouldn't be.
And that's really one of the major sort of macro points of this book as a push-off point. You know, we're living in a time where people are writing obituaries for newspapers every day. But online opinion writing is proliferating like never before. But because many of these columns were written far before the advent of the internet, they haven't been available. And so there's a tendency now to not embrace the reported column as much, instead to embrace a written opinion where research is done, if at all, online. And there's a real value and virtue to getting out from behind your desk, to pounding the pavement, to knocking on doors, and to learning from the best of the past. And now the idea behind this book is they're available in one book, and you realize these guys like Mencken, Kempton, Breslin, Ernie Pyle, these are reported columns. They're vivid storytelling written before television, and they endure with power because of it.
Right, and no one ever told them the word search engine optimization in terms of what to put in their lead. So let's reset a little bit and say that I'm talking with, and if you want to identify the voices, in studio with me is John Avlin, who's a senior columnist for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, and you see him on CNN. In studio with me is Errol Lewis, who listeners to this show should know because he's been in my seat on a few times, NY1 News, where he hosts the Inside City Hall show. And on the phone is Jesse Angelo, editor-in-chief of The Daily. Among the three of you, did two of you start it? Where did the idea come from?
It was very much Phipps' concept right from the beginning, to picking the title, I might add, where he and I were both at the old New York Sun, not far from here. And we used to sit and talk about writing and about columns and about how to make the stuff better. We were both sort of proteges of the late Jack Newfield. And the question was put to him. It's like, look, what's the best column you ever read? Where should we be looking? Who should we be stealing from besides you? And the question came back. The answer came back. Westbrook Pegler, best column you'd ever read. The death of Frankie Jerome. And I was like, I never heard of Westbrook Pegler. I didn't know what he was talking about. and it took quite a while to hunt it down. So Phipp did go and hunt it down.
Yeah, and Jesse
Phipp,
and I,
by the way, I didn't
that's
that.
My nickname, and we're all friends. Jesse and I grew up together in the city, and when he was, you know, executive editor at the Post at a very young age, and I was working for Rudy Giuliani, but we started talking about this book, you know, just through the years, and got excited about it, and it's great to see an idea finally come together.
Now, Westbrook Pegler, who I didn't realize I had known about, but I did know about. His columns are in here. He brought disgrace to himself later in life, and yeah, perhaps some would argue during life, by doing such things as more or less calling for the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy and being so radical that the John Birch Society didn't even want him, yeah, writing for them. Not a disqualifier if his earlier work is good, and there's a Huey Long column that gets it exactly right. My question for you about Westbrook Pegler is it that he said the same thing about everyone, i.e. they're fascists, and about Huey Long he happened to nail it, and about FDR he didn't?
He clearly went off the deep end, I think, in his mind. I mean, he clearly became, I think, unhinged. And was clearly, you know, a John Bircher and paranoid, and you know, saw communists under his bed and was anti-Semitic. But I think in the early days, you know, he really was a very powerful writer and turned out some great stuff.
He was powerful. That's
and that's, you know, that's important. I mean, there's not a character litmus test here. And when, right, he was in his prime, he was not crazy. And he, one of the things he would do is he would attack both communism and fascism, and was pretty consistent about it. But I was stunned by how much power the power of his writing endures, the clarity. And you know, he and Hayward Brown feuded in their lifetime, and yet they're two clearly the greatest columnists of their times, and they're set side by side in many of the different sections of the book. And we should say the book's organized thematically. It's organized into sections. War, politics, sports, humor, crime, civil rights. So you do get different looks at different themes. And you can, you know, we wrote the book so you can skip around. And part of the idea is these columns read well beautifully today because they're tailor-made for short attention span.
The other really interesting juxtaposition with Westbrook Pegler, I don't know if you realize this, you must have, but one of your columnists investigated another for sedition. because Westbrook Pegler hated Eleanor Roosevelt. And Roosevelt demanded that FDR really put the screws to him in terms of a sedition investigation.
This is all part of a conversation between the generations, Mike. That's what it is.
I don't know if Royko and Kempton had a similar back and forth. We're speaking with John Avlin, Jesse Angelo, and Errol Lewis, author of Deadline Artists, America's Greatest Newspaper Columns. And newspaper columns, although they're literally, they fade with age, the great ones are indelible. And we're asking you, do you remember one or two from your lifetime? What stuck out about a great column or a great columnist? Our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-9692. Especially what excites me is a column whose ideas I at least started disagreeing with. And if you can, and there's the column to galvanize and the column to describe, but if you could really change someone's opinion, that's a great thing in a column. Now, some people don't even try for that. And I think that when you talk about the online columns, I think they're speaking to their silos. But this is what I love about David Brooks. You know, he could write mostly for the readership of the Times, who probably doesn't share, he's been called the conservative that liberals like, but doesn't share, at least from the outset, the things he's trying to argue. And he puts forth such great arguments.
That is a large part of, I think, the accomplishment of a great column. And it is this kind of, it's part of a civic conversation. It is a vital extension of our democracy. These columns, these opinions are put forward that try to persuade. And the best of them are still incredibly relevant today. You mentioned David Brooks. Peggy Noonan, I think, is my, probably my favorite columnist writing today. Brooks, I agree with politically a lot, but Peggy Noonan is a storyteller as well. Her voice carries. You know, Tom Friedman still has enormous impact. Carl Hiaasen, writing for the Miami Herald, or Leonard Pitts. You know, Hiaasen writes novels and is a humorist, but also makes deadly serious points beneath the humor. What's amazing to me is not only how this tradition endures, but we don't maybe appreciate it enough, but also how many great novelists and authors were columnists themselves. Hunter S. Thompson wrote a column for the San Francisco Examiner. Orson Welles wrote a column for the New York Post at the end of the Second World War. Teddy Roosevelt wrote a column for the Kansas City Star.
And Hiaasen's also a lyricist for Warren Zevon. Jesse, you were going to say?
I was just going to say, I think the other thing to keep in mind is it's tough, I think, in this day and age to remember how powerful somebody like a Haywood Braun was, how big an impact those columns had because they were so widely syndicated. And, you know, they were the equivalent of sort of the most well-known sort of television commentators that we have now. You know, their impact was gigantic.
Yeah.
Tom from Brooklyn, what columnist do you hold? And hello, and welcome to WNYC. What columnist do you hold, dear?
I hold Russell Baker very close to my heart. I'm also from Baltimore. He started at the Baltimore Sun. And I don't even remember how long he's been gone, but I'll just keep it a short comment. He's the one I miss. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
You got it, Tom.
And we've got two Russell Baker columns in the book. Exactly right. And what we want to do is help introduce the new generation to Russell Baker, just how great he was. He's revered by so many columnists today and readers and writers like the caller.
His memoir of growing up, I mean, he wrote a few, but his first memoir of growing up in Baltimore is also a great memoir of childhood and coming up. So we're talking a lot about the city columnists. I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but in the last 50 years, it seems to me that Mike Royko is the most influential, revered among columnists. Now, you guys are columnists. I'm a reader. What do you think?
I think the big three in terms of city columnists, maybe big four, are clearly Royko, Breslin, and Kempton. I mean, I think they're all heavyweights. And then you've got, you know, people who are in their orbit, clearly Pete Hamill, Mike Barnicle in Boston at his prime. You know, but it's the big city columnist is such an iconic figure. And that's one of the inspirations for the book.
And of course, some of it did not travel outside of their cities. So, I mean, one of the joys of all of this and putting this stuff together for me was to meet new people and get introduced to cities, other cities in a way that I hadn't. So Steve Lopez writing out of Philadelphia, unbelievably good stuff. I mean, you've got Lopez, you've got Pete Dexter, you've got Mitch Albom, who I'd never heard of, writing out of Detroit. These are folks who, you know, they made a decision to stay local. They learned and spoke to a particular place and time, and they can make it come alive in a way that where even if you've never set foot in Detroit, you could say, oh, wow, I get it.
Lopez then moved to the L.A. Times.
Still there.
Yeah,
he's doing great
work. Dexter moved to California, too.
And Dexter is now a full-time novelist, but Lopez did one of his columns, which is in the book, became the basis for the movie The Soloist.
Right. That was his interaction with the homeless guy.
Go ahead,
Jesse.
Sorry to interrupt. To Royko, you know, I grew up in New York, so obviously I knew all the New York names intimately and was familiar with their work. And I knew who Mike Royko was, but in researching this book, I really had the pleasure of really reading deep and reading all of his anthologies. And he is so good day in and day out. And one of the columns in here that I love, and I think might be my favorite, is the obituary he wrote of Mayor Daley. The day of his death.
And to put it in context, we're talking about, you know, Ahab and his whale with Royko and Daley.
But that's exactly right. So, and to think, you know, 30 years of history between the two men, very personal, and for him to churn out in 3 hours on his death what he wrote is incredibly powerful.
This is Mike Pascoe in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're going to come back and get more, a little more into Royko, a little bit into Buckley, William Sapphire. Some calls on the phone are talking about William Sapphire. I see one for Maureen Dowd. I see one for Victor David Davis Hanson, isn't it? Our number again is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned. Hi, this is Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC, speaking with the editors of a book called Deadline Artists, America's Greatest Newspaper Columns. The editors are John Avalon and Errol Lewis, who joined me in studio, and Jesse Angelo, who is on the phone. Let's go right to a call, because we're also asking for your remembrances of the greatest columns you've read and columnists. Richard from Brooklyn, I think you are a fan of someone who's in this anthology. Go ahead, Richard.
About Heywood Bloom. He was a New York Times sports writer, and he got an assignment one day to cover the concert by the Budapest String Quartet. So he wrote a column, he wrote an article, and it said, last night the Budapest String Quartet played Mozart. Mozart lost.
That's great.
That's a great remembrance. He's in here, Heywood Braun.
Yeah, he sure is. He was one of the real revelations for me, along with Pegler, because I hadn't really heard of him, and he was a giant in his time. And he was incredibly diverse in terms of the areas, subject areas he covered. He wrote a column called "Even to Judas" that Franklin Delano Roosevelt read in a Christmas Eve fireside chat to the nation, because he was so affected by it. It's really a poem about faith. Rather, a column about faith, but it reads like an extended prose poem. But then he could also write about politics and war. There's a column he did about the St. Louis called "There Is a Ship," which is one of Errol's favorites.
Yeah, it's stunning, actually. I mean, it's written in 1939, and it's about the St. Louis and how it got turned away from port after port, and it was carrying Jews trying to flee Nazism. And it's so haunting for him that early on to have really grasped the enormity of what was about to happen, and to have tried, using the platform that he had, to try and wake up the world. And it's, you know, of course, tragic that it didn't succeed on that level, but it's an incredibly powerful and poignant piece of writing.
Heywood Braun wrote sports. His son was Woody Braun, Heywood Hale Braun, who you might remember from the early days of ESPN and ABC, who would wear outrageously loud sports jackets, but do these very lyrical columns, actually TV reports also. How'd you pick which sports columnists would go in here?
Tough.
It was a very, very tough one. You know, I did a lot of it, and it was such a pleasure to try to select them, right? I mean, you got to read all of Red Smith and these guys. I mean, there were some that were very obvious, Casey at the Bat. Yeah. You know, we were all big fans of Shirley Povich. Mm-hmm. But having to pick, I mean, honestly, you could have done this whole book with great sports columns, right? I mean, you know, those guys were the giants of their age, and it was difficult to winnow it down. We tried to have some that were from different eras. We tried to cover, make sure that we had at least a couple different sports, and then some people like a Damon Runyon, who you love, you'd be surprised how much of his stuff doesn't really read now.
Talk about purple! Talk about sentences that are impenetrable, and yeah. Yeah, it just is. Not only is he talking about sometimes games that are so bygone, you can't even remember that St. Mary's out of California was even a good football team. It just is unrelatable to the modern ear.
But he also, what's interesting about him, though, is you could tell he was so smart. There was an intellectual boredom. He was always trying to push he was always trying to do something different. He couldn't just write a game report. So, for instance, he wrote one baseball game from the perspective of the ball, right? You know, he was always sort of doing these different things. And then eventually, later in his life, they became these sort of stream of consciousness where the game was barely mentioned. And it was just sort of his impressions of the day.
Yeah, sometimes when I read today's sports columnists, I feel like the ball in that I've been battered around a little bit. They all seem to, not all, but so many of the city newspaper columnists who maybe are getting their lunch handed to them by, you know, online sites, more than other kinds of columnists seem to lost their humanity and getting into just the argument and this guy should be fired. They have an opinion. They're allowed to express it. Let's be the most outrageous we can. Maybe we'll get a shot at, you know, some shout show on ESPN.
And what was so shocking to me, or a revelation to me, was just how good the sports writers were, to Jesse's point, and how they may have mastered the art of the lead more than any other columnist in a genre. And guys like Grantland Rice are coming back again in terms of the respect. There's a whole new sports website about literary journalism called Grantland. And here we've got his poem about Seabiscuit, which in turn helped inspire a film, and his column on the Four Horsemen. But Red Smith's work is unbelievable. Shirley Povich, as Jesse said. I mean, you know, there's just revelations, and these leads just stick with you. Jimmy Cannon, W.C. Hines, Death of a Racehorse. And it's part of our hope is that this will help introduce folks to these writers again, and they'll go out and buy their own anthologies of Hines. A friend of ours did that. I mean, you know, you listen to the lead in Bob Constantine, Lewis Knocks Out Schmeling, about the Joe Lewis fight.
Yeah.
Listen to this, buddy, for it comes from a guy whose palms are still wet, whose throat is still dry, whose jaw is still agape from the utter shock of watching Joe Lewis knock out Max Schmeling. That's great stuff, man.
You know, from my own writing, I once realized I was in the middle of this story, and you know what I'm doing? I'm channeling Death of a Racehorse, where just the full brother of Assault line. Have you guys ever had that? You probably haven't gone in saying, I'm going to write a column in the style of X, but...
Of course you have.
Oh, you have?
Of course you have.
Tell
oh, absolutely.
So,
oh, please, absolutely.
Who you aped the most?
I mean, look, for about 6 years, I was a columnist at the New York Daily News, and there was never a question about there being enough substance and stuff to write about. As long, you know, I tend toward politics, I tend toward corruption, and I come out of Brooklyn, and so... You know, there was never a shortage of crime and corruption and politics going on out there in particular. And you try to work with it. It's like, look, I got 600 words, 633 words, really, at the Daily News. And I can tell it backwards. I can try and make it sound like music. I can try and make it sound like somebody else's column. I read a Peggy Noonan, and I'm like, oh, man, I'd love to have somebody have the same reaction to my column that I have to one of hers.
You mean they hire you to write for the West Wing?
Well, yeah. That would be nice. but I mean, actually, you're playing for, you know, sort of bigger and smaller stakes at the same time. It's like, look, I just want somebody to have that warm feeling sitting on the train, you know, on the way home or something like that. And I used to hear from people all the time. They'd say they took one of mine and put it up on their refrigerator or tacked it up in their cubicle.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you want. You want it to live and to last.
John.
Yeah, I mean, it. You know, you clearly, part of this was an education as well as an inspiration, and that's really our kind of big hope, is that a new generation of journalists who we're part of and other folks will read, and they'll realize the art of the craftsmanship of these classic columns and how good it can be, how it's a wasted opportunity to just type out an opinion, that you've got the opportunity to tell a story and to learn from the best of the past, like young jazz musicians do with older jazz musicians. That kind of conversation hasn't happened, in part because this stuff has been very difficult to find, because it's been isolated in libraries on a microfilm and all this stuff. So that was part of the idea of the book and part of why this has been such a labor of love.
Larry from Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Go ahead, Larry.
Oh, yeah, I want to put in a plug for Jimmy Cannon, great sports columnist from the old New York Post, who wrote about everything, a literary sports columnist. And he wrote about the ills and the good things about sports, and had that great line about Joe Lewis. He was a credit to his race, the human race.
Yeah.
And he also wrote this great column called "Nobody Asked Me But," in which he didn't these little opinions of his that were funny, witty, and strange sometimes.
Yeah, if you could pull it off, it's great. If you can't, you're Larry King. But Jimmy Cannon, he was pretty awesome. Jesse, did you do most of the sports, did you say?
I did a lot of the sports, yeah.
Yeah, and what do you think about Jimmy Cannon? I mean, these are the guys you hear about, but you don't read except for maybe one or two columns. You know, the gentlemen start your coffins. You know, one or two lines. When you read the full breadth of the columns, you get a better appreciation for the craftsmanship.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy Cannon is obviously one of the all-time greats, and as executive editor of the Post, very very dear to my heart. And that was one of the tough ones, you know, to your point of how do you pick? I mean, the guy, you know, wrote for 30, 40 years, and we ended up going with the Graziano Zale fight from Jimmy Cannon, which is sort of a not quite what you'd expect, I think, but it's a great column. I highly recommend it to you, the caller. You should definitely check it out.
And you know, speaking about some of the great women who are in these books, and you guys mentioned Peggy Noonan, Anna Quinlan has great columns.
Sure.
Maureen Dowd's in the book.
Molly Ivins.
Talk about Molly Ivins, because we were talking about it off
air. Man, I love Molly Ivins. I mean, you read her stuff, her voice is crystal clear. She is funny. And a really wide range. In this book, we've got a column of her covering the Clinton campaign, which is just a classic, you know, campaign on the hustings kind of column. We've got a column of where she talks about Lubbock, Texas, and how she tries to translate Texas to normal people. And there's she said one of her favorite songs in Texas from Lubbock, Texas was "I Wish I Was in Dixie," but she's not home tonight. And then a great column which really will make you cry on the other end of the spectrum, called "A Short Story About the Vietnam Memorial Wall," which may be one of my favorite columns in the book. And she basically talks about the generation's experience with Vietnam as a short story. It's literally that. And it is a beautiful, affecting piece of writing that deserves to be regarded as literature.
And some old ones from the 19th century as well that will take you by surprise, such as Margaret Fuller in the 1840s, writing about New York City in a column called "She Bids Farewell to New York," which is a fantastic column. She writes, and I just have it here in front of me, quote, "Vice and crime, if flagrant and frequent, are less thickly coated by hypocrisy than elsewhere."
That's an enduring message.
Some of our listeners nominate Jack Anderson. Jack Anderson is my benchmark. It was his passionate, well-reasoned columns that got me to write my first letter to my congressman to demand that Richard Nixon not be allowed to get away with Watergate. Guess what? It worked. Nat Hentoff should be up there. He delves into his stories with such gusto and tells them with smart precision, still vital. Nat Hentoff. Tim Robbins has been nominated. People talk about Red Smith and Sidney Harris. You were going to say?
Well, this is all what we wanted to do. We wanted to start a conversation. We don't view this book as definitive. We tried to talk to all working columnists now, talk to journalism professors. The Jack Anderson column in this book was suggested by Jack Anderson's biographer. It's where he's writing about how he found out he was being spied on by the FBI and the CIA at Nixon's order. But we want this. We don't consider this definitive. We consider this a start of a conversation. And we really want to encourage that conversation. I'd love it if there was a volume two. I'd love it if, you know, we dig deeper into each of these areas, because frankly, there was a lot we had to cut just for space purposes.
What about were there any here that were obscure in their lifetime? Were there any finds, if you will?
You know, there are folks like O. Henry, who people don't appreciate, that he wrote a column for the Houston Chronicle, Post Chronicle, before he wrote short stories. And you read his work in the 1890s, and when Houston is a very different town, and you get a very clear sense of this is what those short stories are going to come out of. So there are obscurities like that.
I think there's somebody like Richard Harding Davis that is really not known to the modern audience, and it's hard to overstate what a big deal he was at the turn of the century. He was sort of the first sort of superstar newspaper columnist.
And there are people who were a big deal, but you don't think of them as having their major impact through the column. And I'd even put William F. Buckley in that category. I mean,
right. We
know about him from Firing Line. We know about him as a conservative activist. We know about him as the impact that he had with National Review. But, you know, it was really by, you know, banging out that column to 500 newspapers every week that he really reached the most people.
And there was one revelation to me, a guy named Wells Twombly, who died in the 70s in his late 30s, and has a column in the book about there was only one Casey. It was a tribute to Casey Stengel.
Great sports writer, yeah.
He was a great sports writer and hasn't been anthologized since his death, and didn't write books widely, wrote columns. And it was just a revelation.
His bio note in the back is as good as a column in that he was saying, let me read. Oh, you wrote that. Good. I don't want anyone skimming through anything I write. I've been battling with the who, what, where, why, when, and the KISS, keep it simple, stupid crowd ever since I started. Lord, we're in a war with television. I try to recreate scenes for readers, take them places where even the damned camera can't go.
Exactly. Shirley Povich's son, of course, is Maury Povich, and Maury told us that his father, 50 years this guy covered sports, day in and day out, and he said even to his last days he slaved over every word, that he was the last guy in the office every night trying to get every single word of his copy perfect. And to your point earlier, Mike, about there are some columnists in this day and age who sort of mail it in. These guys didn't mail it in.
Right. Now, some of them weren't like that. Just like in any walk of life, some stare at the paper until beads of blood form on your forehead. Mm-hmm. And some of them could really pump it out. And the other thing that, from what I know about them, someone once said about actors, it's strange. Half of them are totally inarticulate offstage. Think about De Niro. And half of them could light up a room. Think about Alec Baldwin or Kevin Spacey. Now, you guys personally know more of these columnists than I do. Some of them are unbelievably articulate, and some of them without a typewriter or a pen, you would never suspect that they have this wit within them. Well, what do you think of the ones you know?
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Without getting myself in any trouble, a guy like Stanley Crouch, who was a friend and a mentor and a really good guy and a fabulous writer, and a sort of a polymath, guy plays jazz, he does a little this, he does a little that, but he is really, really interesting if you can sit him down. But I'll tell you, I learned more about writing what he knows about writing by reading him than anywhere else. Yeah. You sit and try and talk with him, and we just had him on the show the other day, and he went metaphorical. He says, well, it's like when in jazz, sometimes you play with a mute, sometimes you don't play with a mute. Or, what else did he say? He said, read all of Ernest Hemingway. By the end of it, you'll know everything about writing.
Right, yeah. And Hemingway was a columnist as well. And there are two of his pieces in here, very different. One about the Spanish Civil War, one about Chicago gangland violence. But the point I think that Crouch was making, too, is that it's amazing how much of the great column writing also came from tabloids. Yep. Is it written directly, to the people? It's populist. It is hard-hitting. It is not highbrow. And that's one of the things that gives it surreal power. And you realize, the incredible literary journalism that came out of columnists who were writing in the Post. In particular, in the 1940s, 50s. Murray Kempton wrote, what reads like literature today in the New York Post. Royko was a tabloid columnist. And his stuff also is literature. It has literary quality, but it was never talking down. It was a direct conversation, and that's why it resonated.
Right. Breslin, Royko. This was a guy from your neighborhood who he established, Molly Ivins, a different kind of neighborhood. Established that she was one of you, and then could do the thing where he pulls you out a little bit, where he, since you know him and trust him, he'll make a point that maybe you didn't realize, and then you say, yeah.
Can we say one thing about Breslin? Because he's still with us, and I can't overestimate what a giant he is. Breslin at his best will beat anybody. And you read his stuff in the wake of the JFK assassination, where he famously zigged when everybody else zagged. He interviewed the gravedigger in a column called It's an Honor. He interviewed the attending room physician at the hospital in Dallas in one of my favorite columns, A Death in Emergency Room 1. Breslin, you can't overestimate, to my mind, just how good and influential he was. And it's really an honor, frankly, that we're all sharing the same city with him still.
But then some of the stuff, the character driven stuff, you go back and read it, and it doesn't hold up.
But the gang that doesn't shoot straight kind of does.
Yeah.
Carl Meyer. Hello, Carl.
Yes.
You're part of this history we're talking about.
I just wanted to say I'm delighted that you're doing your anthology. I published in 1990. An anthology of columns starting from Ben Franklin and ending with Maureen Dowd, called Pundits, Poets, and Wits.
Of course, we thank you in the acknowledgments,
yes.
Carl.
Oh, you do.
Oh, yeah.
Seen your book.
No. Yeah, we your book was one of the many that we referred to, and it's a great book, and I want to thank you for that. We tried to sort of update it and expand it, and
I'm delighted you're doing it, and. I'm fascinated by some of the things that you picked up or that I've just heard about on the air. When is your book out, and where can I get it?
In stores right now.
Came out last week, and online or in a local bookstore, independent bookstore. But absolutely. Thank you for doing that. And yes, you're on page something or other. I don't know. We can say that with some confidence.
I have only one modest correction to make. It's not Haywood Brown. It's Brune.
Brune, yeah.
He was a good friend of my father's who was also a columnist. I'm a third-generation journalist, so I'm delighted when anyone tries to rescue from the archives all the stuff that should be given more permanent form.
Thank you for the call, yeah. Carl. And I noticed that Jesse thanks Rupert Murdoch in his acknowledgments, and he's on line six. Hello, Rupert. No, it's David from Manhattan. David, are you an ex-postman?
Yeah, this is David Alpern. I run a show that's heard on WNYC Sunday mornings called For Your Ears Only and around the country. I worked at the Post in the 60s. A name I don't think you've mentioned is Murray Kempton.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing about Breslin is that he was at that interesting transition point where he blurred fiction and fact. He did great interviews. He did great reportage. But he also put a great question mark in the days before The Daily Show, writing about characters where, at least for the first couple of years in the Trib, you never knew, is that real? Is that real? And it raised a real doubt about, I'm afraid, the veracity of journalism, and that's only gone on and on, I'm afraid, these days.
Well, you make a great point. We have one of those columns, those character-driven columns called Marvin the Torch, where it's one of his profiles of an arsonist, and he also had Fat Tony and a whole bunch.
Was there a lion in the basement in Brooklyn?
Yeah, and I think it's a columnist, and these are characters, and some blurring of that line clearly was done a lot in the past, but I think there's a purpose to it. There's an enduring to it, and you mentioned Murray Kempton. We have spoken about him and couldn't respect his work more, his kindness and his wisdom.
He wrote when his arch rival DeSapio was beaten, and he wrote a wonderful ironic column about how the roses were blooming in the sidewalks now and everything would be better because Carmen DeSapio had been defeated.
Awesome. Thanks for the call, David. And we see some of the tradition of making up these characters and maybe some of Maureen Dowd's columns where she gets inside the minds in a way that she really could in real life. I was thinking of a couple that weren't in your book. Do you remember the Dowd column a few years ago when the Democrats took out that ad that had the word rats in it quite prominently?
Oh, yeah.
And then Maureen Dowd wrote a column that had these bolded words that spelled out a secret message. That was an awesome column. There was another one a couple months ago that Dwyer, is Jim Dwyer in here? I don't know if I noticed him here.
He's not. We had to cut a lot of people. And we actually had to cut this book almost in half.
Okay, so Jim Dwyer is great, and he wrote A Funeral of a Westie, one of the West Side Gang members.
Oh, that's a great piece, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this is why, frankly, I mean, I would love to do a volume two because of columns like that. Yeah. I mean, this is a start, and we know that, and a guy like Dwyer is great. And part of the actually great thing about the book coming out is all the feedback we're getting about people saying, I love your book. I hadn't been looking for this column for years. And you know, it's another one I remember?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, Byliner.com did a great review of the book, and they brought out some of their favorites. So it's part of that conversation that we wanted to start.
And by the way, the Pulitzer Prize for columnists or commentary, it's pretty good. It's a pretty good list. They seem to have nailed it pretty well. Maybe
more or less. Yeah, there's people missing, but Peggy should be in there. But we drew heavily from that. I mean, when the Maureen Dowd column that's in the book is one of the ones she won for covering the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and where she said, you know, the president should not resign, not for this. This is a matter of divorce.
There's another great one in here that I think also won the Pulitzer, Gene Weingarten in the Washington Post. Why not the worst?
Yeah, really funny.
It's a very long piece, but really one of the best. It's about trying to find, in essence, the true armpit of America, trying to find the worst place in America.
Gene Weingarten is a treasure because he won the Pulitzer last year for the least funny subject in the world, children who died in the backseats of cars. And it's not commentary. It's a feature. It's fantastic. And you see the talent of a lot of the people in the book. And also, I think in our past 45 minutes, we've heard the talent assembled before me in the form of John Avalon, Errol Lewis. On the phone was Jesse Angelo. They're the editors of Deadline Artists, America's Greatest Newspaper Columns. Thank you guys all so much for putting this book together and for being with me.
Thanks. Had a great time.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. In a moment, we'll be talking about the construction of hundreds of New York City public schools. Stay with us.